The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Georgine Rice. This week, we'll look at the horrific and racially motivated murder of 10 in Buffalo, New York, last weekend.
The biggest problem is not what this young man carried in his hands. It's actually what he carried in his heart.
After 2 years of pandemic, it's hard to think of a sector that has fared worse than public education.
Parents in record numbers are pulling their kids out of the public schools.
J.D. Vance wins the Republican nomination for the Senate seat in Ohio.
Look, I'm 100% pro-life and I'm proud to be.
We'll look at why the pro-life position has to be defended.
A whole human being is similar to a Polaroid photo. Everything that was necessary for the photo to realize its full development was already present when the photo got spit out.
All this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, and I'm glad to be with you once again. I'm coming to you from Portland and my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin with a horror in Buffalo. Last week, on a quiet Saturday afternoon, a young man, 18 years old, entered a top grocery store in Buffalo, New York, and proceeded to murder 10 of the shoppers and workers. The location had been targeted because the gunman knew the area was largely black. Here's Albert Moeller from his Briefing podcast.
By now, more is known of the situation there in Buffalo, but we're looking at a tragedy. We're looking at evil. And that's, again, one of the words we simply find to be essential in our vocabulary. If we can't use the word evil and it doesn't mean something in objective reality, then we are in a world of absolute moral nonsense. What took place in that supermarket in Buffalo was unalloyed, undiluted evil. It was an intentional act, we now understand, undertaken by a lone gunman who was trying to kill as many people as possible in that supermarket, particularly according to his own words. In what can only be described as a horrific manifesto that he left behind. As you look at those words, it is clear he was trying not only to kill as many people as possible, but as many black people as possible. After he was interrupted in his killing spree, he turned the weapon on himself, but before firing, he was talked into surrendering by local law enforcement personnel. He is now in custody. He is a teenager. He has been charged with several counts of first-degree murder, and there are looming federal charges having to do with hate crimes and potential terrorism charges as well. In this case, by the way, what we're looking at is not a big question as to who did it. It's pretty apparent that the suspect in this case did it. He was basically apprehended in the act of doing it, and furthermore, left behind a written manifesto telling the world why he did what he did. As dark as that manifesto is, it certainly points to the workings of his own mind. That written document also turns out to be of extreme moral significance because, in this case, he has given us his own words explaining why he sought to kill as many people as possible and to target those people as he did in that supermarket in Buffalo. And by the way, we also know he had to travel to Buffalo in order to carry this out. We also know something that points to the deep, deep evil that was in and perhaps still is very much in this man's heart. And that is an evil that led him even to do some demographic analysis, trying to find the neighborhood that would be most racially concentrated for him to be able to carry out his mass murder plans in the way that he had intended. He went to Buffalo on a singular mission to try to kill as many black people as possible. He tells us so. We understand exactly what the sheriff of Erie County, New York, meant, that Sheriff John Garcia, when he said, quote, "This was pure evil," end quote. Speaking of the teenager, his manifesto and his actions, and of course, the 10 people shot dead in that Buffalo, New York supermarket. But let's look at the statement for a minute. Four words. This was pure evil. Now, we don't actually know what pure evil is, other than what is revealed in Scripture as the pure evil of, say, Satan and his associates in rebelling against God. The evil of sin is in itself pure evil. But I'm not quibbling with the sheriff. I simply think he was speaking in common language here, and he was speaking a profound moral truth. But I think what he actually meant when he said pure evil is absolute evil. This is just unquestionably, objectively evil. Now, in the biggest scheme of things, that points to the fact that even in an age of increasing moral confusion, there is absolute moral clarity in an event such as this, a tragedy, an action, a sin, a horrific crime such as this. All of a sudden, it focuses our attention on something that Christians know from Scripture, and all people should actually know from even the moral structure of creation, as God has made the creation to testify of his moral law. And that is that evil is real. Evil is not just an apparition. Evil is not just non-being. Evil is not just non-existence. Evil is objectively real in the biblical category of that with which we must struggle. And indeed, it is so much more powerful than we are in our humanity that there is no way that human beings, singularly or corporately altogether, can defeat evil. Only God can do that. And that is exactly what God did on the cross and in the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. But the point is this, and this is where Christians have to focus, even as the world doesn't focus here. The real problem, and the biggest problem facing humanity, is not what this young man carried in his hands. No, that's horrifying beyond words. It's actually what he carried in his heart. And that's infinitely, if we're honest, more horrifying.
After 2 years of pandemic, Americans are pretty much done with all things COVID. Well, at this point, most have had the virus and many lives have been lost. But the cost of the virus on society at large has been significant as well. I'm referring to our government's response to the virus. Children have paid a very heavy price, particularly those in public schools, and parents have had it. Craig Roberts and Lance Izumi of the Pacific Research Institute from KFAX in San Francisco.
I guess to the greatest degree, Lance, the pandemic here in California really kind of pulled the lid off of the last of the, the wizard behind the curtain, as we began to see not only were there policies related to COVID that became extremely problematic, but as parents spent more time at home with their kids during the pandemic, I think also gained a greater understanding of just how much they really don't know as a result of being involved in public education in our state.
No, that's absolutely right, Craig. It really was, lifting up the blanket that has long covered public education in this state. I mean, what the parents discovered is, first of all, the public schools were simply not effective at teaching the basic subjects to kids during the pandemic when you had remote distance learning. I mean, a lot of kids were barely online for maybe an hour or two during the time that the pandemic was going on. There was virtually no real teaching going on, which is why you see research that just came out a few months ago showing that during the pandemic that, across America, the kids lost 4 months' worth of reading loss, and they had 4 months' worth of reading loss and 5 months' worth of math loss during the pandemic. And if you were from a low-income family, for example, you experienced 6 to 7 months' worth of learning loss. So, you had these massive losses of learning. On top of the fact, as you pointed out in your monologue to start off this hour, that we were already at a very low level to begin with. Now you add on top of that additional learning losses because of the ineffectiveness of the public schools, and then you have a huge disappointment academically with the schools on the part of parents, but then also, too, you see the indoctrination that's going on, and it's blatant. It is, often there's a lack of transparency that teachers and the schools are trying to keep things from parents. But, for the parents, they were able to see a lot of this because they were looking over the shoulders of their kids and not liking what they're seeing, which is one of the reasons why I wrote my book, The Homeschool Boom, is because, you had all of these different factors, the pandemic, the distance learning, you know, parents being able to see for the first time what's going on. And that's why, you know, parents in record numbers are pulling their kids out of the public schools across the country and in California. And millions of parents have pulled their kids out. And we've seen a drop in public school enrollment across the country, anywhere from 2 to 3 million. And therefore, a lot of those kids are actually being homeschooled. Some of them are going to private schools, but actually the majority of those kids are now being homeschooled because parents want the control that only homeschooling can really truly give them when it comes to what is taught to their children.
Wow. Now, the one concern in all of this is that not every parent can do this, obviously. So when you see such startling increase, as you point out, more than doubled since the launch of the pandemic, in your mind, is this indicative, Lance, of a growing number of parents in California that have said, you know what, we're willing to make the extreme sacrifice of time and finances, quite frankly, in order to make this happen? Because after all, your kids only get one shot at a fundamental foundational education, and upon which everything else in life is built on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Craig. Absolutely right. I think parents are making that decision as you and I speak, that you know, they cannot afford to allow their kids to stay in a school system that is not only indoctrinating their children, but also failing to provide them with the academic and knowledge skills necessary for them to succeed in life. And so, I mean, if you're going to raise your child, you know, you need to have them in a situation where they're going to get the best type of learning experience possible. And they're certainly not getting it, for the most part, in the regular public schools, which I should point out. You know, if you look at the federal data on who's homeschooling, what you find is that actually the proportion of families who are making $25,000 or less who are homeschooling is actually higher than the proportion of families who are homeschooling who are making between $100,000 and $150,000. And what that is saying is that, first of all, their kids are probably going to some of the worst schools, you know, in their area. Secondly, they're making that sacrifice. Maybe they were making more money, but they're willing to forego that money in order to get their kids out of a failure factory masquerading as a public school and homeschool them at home so that they can have a chance in life. And so I think that's what you're seeing. And I think that one of the reasons why you're seeing this increase is not just because of the failure of the regular public schools, but also because the pandemic has actually opened up the workplace to much more flexible hours, much more flexible, you know, arrangements such as working at home. So it actually becomes much more doable for many more parents to homeschool their children than before, when everybody seemed to have to go to a 9-to-5 job and that was very rigid and you didn't have a lot of exceptions to that. And now you see so many people who have much more flexible schedules, which make it much easier for them to fit homeschooling into that schedule.
Coming up, making the case for life once again.
A whole human being is similar to a Polaroid photo. Everything that was necessary for the photo to realize its full development was already present when the photo got spit out.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. The nation continues to wait for the Supreme Court to release its decision in the case of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. If indeed Roe versus Wade is overturned, we know abortion is not immediately outlawed or immediately limited. The question returns to the states and to the political process. J.D. Vance won the May 3rd primary for the Senate seat in Ohio. He'll be the Republican facing Democrat incumbent Congressman Tim Ryan. Vance was a guest of Bob Burney on The Word, 880 AM in Columbus.
I don't think I've ever seen a primary, particularly for Senate, with so many qualified candidates. And Honestly, I could have backed at least four, possibly five, and you would be included in that. And I think that speaks well of conservatism in Ohio, that we were able to put forth so many good, qualified candidates. Would you concur with that?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. We definitely had a solid field, and that's part of the reason why it was so contentious. You know, sometimes, you know, most primaries, even with people who are guaranteed to win, you have at least four or five candidates in the race. They're not contentious because those candidates aren't very serious. I think we've got a quality party. We've got some good leaders here in Ohio. I don't think we've seen the last of a lot of the people we were running against. I think Bernie Moreno's got a bright future. I think, you know, Jane Timken has already done a whole lot. Sure. We'll continue to do a whole lot for the conservative movement in the future. I'd say the same, of course, of Mike Gibbons and Josh Mandel. So I think that we're in a good place as a party. And I think we really have to beat this guy, Tim Ryan, in November, because as much as he tries to pretend to be a moderate, he pretty much is the opposite of almost every single one of our values. And, you know, his actual record in public life has been 100% Joe Biden Democrat.
Roe v. Wade is huge right now.
Sure.
Tim Ryan's record is evil. Do you expect abortion to be a big issue in the Senate campaign coming up?
I don't know. I think that the Democrats seem to want it to be an issue, but I think they're mistaken on this. I mean, I know you probably know a lot of Republicans, and I certainly know a lot of Republicans, Bob, who the only reason they vote for Republican candidates is because they want to see an end to abortion on demand in this country.
Yeah.
And I think that if Roe gets overturned, it's going to fire those people up in a very big way. So I think the Democrats are wrong about the politics of this, first of all. But you're right. Look, I mean, I Tim Ryan's views on abortion are wicked. I will go that far because, look, I'm 100% pro-life and I'm proud to be. And Tim Ryan, despite, again, he's the guy who said he was pro-life a few years ago, is now running as a radical on the abortion issue. I mean, right. I really would not have believed if you had told me 5 years ago that Democrats would be defending abortion on demand for full-term babies. And yet here we are, and it's definitely one of the most vile parts of their platform.
If indeed Roe versus Wade is overturned, abortion would go back to the political process. But that doesn't mean it would be limited to the political process. The challenge and the opportunity comes back to each one of us in a new way. An opportunity to make the case for life anew and afresh. That's what a young pro-life activist, Seth Gruber, is doing. He was a guest of Charlie Kirk.
There is this kind of raging debate around abortion in our country. It shouldn't be much of a debate. And let's just kind of start at the basics, which is for a listener right now who might be agnostic on it without knowledge or just kind of people can make whatever decision as they see fit. What's wrong with that perspective? Why should a listener of the Charlie Kirk Show care about life?
Yeah. Amen. I gave a talk to a Republican women's group recently in Simi Valley about why conservatives actually have to be pro-life if you want to call yourself a conservative. Mm-hmm. You know, and our founder said we hold these truths to be self-evident, right? The translation for that for Gen Zers is duh. You know, we hold these truths to be duh. This is obvious. It's axiomatic that we're endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights. And of course, he put the right to life first. And Reagan talked about this at length in his book, Abortion and the Conscience of a Nation. Reagan, former governor of California, used to be pro-choice and actually had some blood on his hands because of pro-choice.
He signed some bad bills, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And Dr. Mildred Jefferson, the first black woman to graduate from Harvard Medical School, who started the National Right to Life Committee, once gave a defense of the pro-life position so persuasively on TV, Reagan watched it, wrote her a letter, and said that he had become pro-life because of her presentation. And he wrote his book, Abortion and the Conscience of a Nation. And he makes this point, to your question about why life is the most fundamental right and why we as conservatives need to get that right. He says that Abraham Lincoln recognized that we could not survive as a free country as long as some men could decide that others are not fit to be free and should therefore be slaves. Likewise, we cannot survive as a free land today as long as some men can decide that others are not fit to live and should therefore be abandoned to abortion and infanticide. So there is no cause more important than affirming than the transcendent right to life of all human beings, the right without which no other rights have any meaning.
Well, the other side will say, Seth, the fetus is the size of a pebble. Like, you can't possibly say that's the same thing as a 6'3" person.
Right. It's ageism, right?
That's what they say.
We hate racism. We hate sexism in this country. But apparently ageism is not just acceptable, but it's been normalized. The child is not the same size as us simply in virtue of their development. So let's look at what the science of embryology says. From the moment of conception, there's a distinct living and whole human being. Distinct because it's obviously not your DNA, not your choice, as you like to say. The body in her body is not her body. And we know that because the baby could be a different gender than the mother. Obviously, pregnant women don't have male genitalia, so the baby's distinct. The baby's living because dead things don't grow. The unborn child meets all the requirements for a living thing, and the unborn child is directing her own internal growth from within. So, right, I have two kids, Charlie. My wife never woke me up in the middle of the night shaking me, saying, babe, come here, come whisper to my uterus. Come remind baby to grow. Because unborn children actually, they develop themselves from within, independent of the wishes of their parents. And the child is whole. A whole human being is simply a human being who already has everything they need to realize their full growth and development as a participating member of the human species. And this is where our opponents, Charlie, get very confused when they say, maybe it's like biologically human, like it has like human DNA. It's like cellularly human, but it's not like a full human. Oh, you mean like Untermensch? You mean what the Nazis called subhuman? Oh, right. Not full human, just kind of subhuman. Same type of bigotry with abortion. But they say it might be biologically human, but it's not a human like you and I. So this last concept is the most important for us to articulate to the next generation and to the pro-choice moderates and pro-choice activists in our country. A whole human being is similar to a Polaroid photo. So when you take a picture and this photo gets spit out and you start shaking it, waiting for it to develop. Now, let's say you captured a picture of a phenomenal sunset, Charlie. Mm-hmm. And right as that photo gets spit out, I rip it out of your hands. I tear it up into little pieces and I throw it to the side of the road. Now, you might be frustrated with me. But what if I said, Charlie, calm down. It was not a picture of a sunset. It was just a black smudgy on a white piece of paper. You'd probably say, Seth, what are you talking about? The sunset was already there. We just couldn't see it yet. Everything that was necessary for the photo to realize its full development was already present when the photo got spit out. It just needed time. The same thing is true with our development. And in virtue of being human, the unborn child already has everything he or she needs to realize all of the different cognitive abilities, functions, and accidental properties that will come along with the level of development. But they have an underlying nature to realize those capacities. Similarly, my wife recently found out that men don't reach their mental peak until their 40s. And our wives are probably very encouraged by that, yes. Right? They're really holding out hope for us. But that doesn't mean we're not whole human beings now. So we all find ourselves on a different tick mark on the continuum of human development. But when did the continuum of human development begin? Well, follow the science back to the moment of conception.
For more on Seth's organization, go to unaborted.com. Coming up, the impact of social media on our mental health.
How do I put the guardrails back in my life to keep this healthy?
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. The pace and the negativity of the news cycle can be, well, overwhelming. If you're like an ever-growing percentage of the population, social media in its various forms is a key source for news and information and how we sort through the news. It's not surprising that social media is leaving more and more Americans depressed. Gregory Jantz, author of Social Media and Depression, How to Be Healthy and Happy in the Digital Age, joined my colleague here in the Pacific Northwest, Tim Gatos from AM 820, The Word in Seattle.
It's in the news all the time about Facebook and Twitter and how, you know, their algorithms are working and what's becoming known about how they're essentially working against us as humans. I mean, it's frightening to see kind of behind the scenes, and we're only seeing partially what's going on. What are you seeing, Doctor?
Well, there is a lot going on. And one of the things is the information coming to us is absolutely filtered and controlled and manipulated. No doubt about that. I think we're discovering more and more of this. and there's more to come to light. And what we know is social media can get a real stronghold in a person's life, by the way. You take kids, you take adults. But during this last few years now, pandemic or whatever we want to call this time we've been in, people have turned to the digital world. And now they've stayed in the digital world at a higher level than ever before. And so social media is where I get my news. It's where my relationships are. And social media has a way of distorting reality. So there's a lot we can talk about what's going on, but how is it affecting people? Well, there's some good parallels and correlations between social media use and how I'm using it and depression and anxiety levels.
Hmm. How do you see this? I guess on the ground level, what is the data? I'm sure there's a lot of anecdotal information, a lot of statistical information that shows this. How do you go about diagnosing this?
Right. Well, one of the things is if I'm already on the edge and maybe I've been struggling with some depression and I'm going to social media, maybe for connection, for affirmation, and there's a lot of things that can hook me in. And I can go down a lot of bunny trails, but here's what happens. I get oversaturated with too much information. And that too much information begins to kind of put me in an overwhelmed state. And there are those who have, through the time we're in, have kind of had a break from reality where they don't know what to believe anymore. And that's what's happening. There's a lot of confusion. And we know that there are some good studies, by the way, about depression and social media use. Mm. What we know is the more you're isolated to social media, the more, if you have a tendency already to struggle with some depression, the more that goes up.
Doctor, I wanted to ask, what do you do at the center when it comes to this whole concept of the digital side of things, the devices that are brought in by clients? And how does this work practically at the center?
Oh, sure. Good question, Tim. This is very interesting for us to deal with. We don't want people to be distracted from the work they need to be doing while they're with us. So we're a place where people come for depression, anxiety, maybe addiction, and they're with us for a while. So they're staying here. So upon admissions, we have them check in any device that has a screen. That makes it real simple. Kind of covers anything that has a screen. We're going to check it in. We put it in a safe, and it's initially for 72 hours. Now, there are those that really do have what I'll call digital addiction. They, by that third day of not getting to their device, they are irritable, heart rate's up, sweaty palms, headache, etc. Because they're having kind of mild withdrawal symptoms from their technology. So there really is, I've seen it firsthand, a physiological response when I'm oversaturated and I need to detox from my technology. So we see people detox. Now, they do usually want their device back. You know, maybe we have different rules for that. Maybe on Saturday you can check it out. You need to do some things and you turn it back in. Well, the first week people do. They say, okay, yeah, I'd like to have my device on Saturday. And they check it back in. And sometimes that can be really upsetting. They get involved in something they shouldn't, and it really, you know how it can throw things off. But by week two, and I'm making some general statements, by week two, they go, you know what, I don't think I want to check out my cell phone. I'm doing fine. Hmm. And they're starting to discover something called emotional freedom. It's like, I just got untethered from it. This feels good. I'm feeling good now. I went through detox. And I'm feeling good now. And really is when I have because we all have a relationship with technology, how do I put the guardrails back in my life to keep this healthy? And who's controlling what? Is it controlling you or are you controlling it?
Coming up, anger in our nation.
If you're going to be denounced as subhuman for disagreeing with anything that stands in the form of enforced doctrine by the governing party.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Political polarization, a growing coarseness in our dialogue, and anger seem to mark our nation today. We see it in the news, and we see it in our communities and even in our families. It may feel like politics is at the root of it all. But our next guest argues that politics are really the fruit of what began some time ago. I enjoyed my enlightening conversation with Peter Wood, author of the new book titled Wrath, America Enraged.
After World War II, things began to come apart, I think in two ways. One was that's when Americans really began to discover Freudian psychoanalysis, with the idea that if you repress your anger, it will come back at you in the form of neurosis. So it was more healthy mentally to let it all out. And the other was the importation from Europe after the war of existentialism and an idea that to have an authentic life, you had to be in touch with your darkest emotions and let them out. So those two things were circulating at around the same time in the early 1950s, mostly on the coastal elites, but gradually they spread throughout the rest of society. It's a long story. I won't try to tell it on this interview, but I think what you see happening is that the licensing of anger, this new form of individualism, gains ground because it proves to be such a useful tool for protest. People begin to understand that being angry empowers them and excites other people. Anger becomes something of a spectator sport, and that's one of the first places we really see it, is that sports, which used to be governed by codes of sportsmanship, suddenly become places where people swear and brawl, and it turns out to be one way in which you can make anger into something that is both more lived experience and less controlled. We saw it happening in our mass media, our movies, even in our music, and angrification takes place. I don't see now how you can create a meaningful compromise between people who want the country to have no borders and people who want the borders to be enforced, or people who believe that a woman's right to choose trumps everything, and people who think that the right to life trumps everything. Those are not matters to be settled by a handshake. We have a world right now in which the division between those who think the 2020 election was stolen and those who call that the big lie can't really even talk about it.
Side,
it's boiling mad at the other. Once the opposing idea is put on the table.
I wanted to ask, progressive elites are stoking rage on a range of issues, from anti-racism, critical race theory, efforts to erase American history, the 1619 Project, one example, unfettered illegal immigration, the COVID pandemic response, new voter rights comparisons. What are the risks of losing emotional self-control and the consequences of a culture that indulges too freely in the celebration of anger? And what kind of threat does that pose to the republic?
Well, that's a hefty question. I would say that all of the things you're talking about are backed up with emotional rage. If you try to engage in reasoned argument with somebody who holds the positions that you just listed, you don't get reasoned argument in return. What you get is a kind of denunciation. You're a racist, you're a xenophobe, you're a homophobe, you're some kind of person whose own views are reduced to a pathological, psychological state. So what you get when you license anger to be the tool by which you proceed through disagreements with other people. Well, what you don't get is argument. What you do get is a effort to write the person out of the conversation altogether. The result of that on the political scale means that tens of millions of people are denied the right to participate in their own government. The idea of consent of the governed, which is intrinsic to our republic, disappears because the governed in this case can only be controlled or suppressed. Now, we're talking about a big range of issues. Each of those things is sort of compacted into an ideology in which the view is that social justice, or so-called social justice, lies on one side, and on the other side, there only is this category of the ignorant, the deplorable, those who gravitate towards fascist dictatorship. Terms of abuse that don't really describe what anybody believes at all. Since it's extremely difficult to find anybody who's an actual racist, we have this new concept of systemic racism, which can be applied across the board regardless of what a person really believes or stands mm-hmm. for. That is a kind of pollution of the world of a democratic polity. You can't really engage in politics if you're going to be denounced as subhuman for disagreeing with anything that stands in the form of enforced doctrine by the governing party. Well, I'm saying the governing party, of course, can change. Mm-hmm. And we are now in this situation where we face a government that, in my view, was elected by, let's say, mischief, actions taken that didn't fully comport with the rule of law, has brought in President Biden and Vice President Harris. They have been able to use the levers of government to advance the kinds of policies you're talking about. All that sort of thing rankles, but if you try to express it in the mainstream media in America, you will find yourself not just cut down in that act, but perhaps prohibited from appearing anywhere else. We have these incredibly powerful things like Facebook and Twitter, which seem to have a capacity to say you don't exist. If we disagree with you, we will prohibit you from expressing any views at all on our platform. And since all the platforms interlock with one another, it really creates a class of non-citizens.
Coming up, a place between giving in to anger and giving up on conviction.
But I do encourage them to be thoughtfully forceful in maintaining their opinions against peer pressure.
More with Peter Wood when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to DaybreakInsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's DaybreakInsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's DaybreakInsider.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. When we hear of a scholar writing on the negative impact of anger on the nation, we might conclude that we need to back down, so to speak, in our convictions, to go silent on what we really believe. However, Peter Wood argues that you can engage the angry without responding in anger. Let's listen to a few more minutes with Peter Wood, author of Wrath, America Enraged. What encouragement can you give our listeners as our time is ticking away? Who recognize and will immediately recognize what you write about in the book, but want to do something different, to be constructive, to perhaps move the republic in a direction that's more constructive and favorable to a future?
Well, I took heart from the school board elections and state elections that occurred this month, especially in Virginia, but also in New Jersey, here where I am in New York, where there was a real sign that the public is sufficiently fed up to push back against this. That's one thing. When I see people resisting, as in air traffic controllers or airline pilots, or in New York, it's been nurses and doctors and firefighters and policemen who have put some brakes on this. Whatever we do for a living, we have some opportunity to exert ourselves beyond just our individual choices and to influence other people. Maybe the hardest thing of all to do is to bring this into your actual community, your friends, relations, people that you go to church with. I'm in the midst of that now, and I live in a deep blue part of New York City. I'm on Upper West Side. I am surrounded by people who strongly disagree with my every opinion. And yet I try to pick my way through that by showing people that I can disagree with them without becoming a monster. But I don't want to give up my right to dissent. And I think that that's a hard choice that we each have to make individually about where you're going to dissent and how you're going to do it. And sometimes the results are just not very nice. You lose friends, or in one of my cases, a group at church just broke up because people couldn't stand knowing, not even expressing, that others held different views. I think it's important that that kind of thing actually happen, that you don't live in fear of it happening to the point where you begin to compromise away your right to self-expression.
Yeah.
I don't encourage people to be antagonistic, but I do encourage them to be thoughtfully forceful in maintaining their opinions against peer pressure.
Thank you for joining us for The Christian Outlook. There's more to my conversation with Peter Wood, and you can hear the full interview at ChristianOutlook.com. While you're at our site, remember to subscribe to our podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Mike Cook, Alex Perez, and James Blend, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.